if you've spent any time following American politics recently, you haven't just seen disagreement, you've felt antagonism. It's an intensely angry, often venomous atmosphere where conflicts feel completely intractable.
Yeah, it really does feel that way.
And we usually assume this venom stems from vast fundamental disagreements on policy, right?
Yeah.
Like taxes, healthcare, climate action, or foreign policy. We think the reason we hate each other is because we disagree on what we think.
Exactly. And that assumption, that ideology is the core problem.
Yeah.
That's precisely what political scientist Liliana Mason challenges in her crucial work, Uncivil Agreement, how politics became our identity.
Okay.
Mason delivers, I think, a profoundly important reframing of the current crisis.
And the central argument is this. The true problem isn't the ideological gap between average citizens, which hasn't actually widened dramatically. The real problem is the near-perfect alignment of our core social identities.
Right.
Your party affiliation is no longer just a political choice. It's become this kind of all-encompassing social identity. And that alignment, she argues, has turned politics into tribal warfare.
It changes everything, doesn't it? So the mission for us in this deep dive is to give you the blueprint for this conflict. We want to answer the question, why are Americans showing these unprecedented levels of hatred and distrust toward the opposing party, even if their policy differences haven't substantially widened?
Let's unpack this shift from policy debate to identity war.
Okay.
Okay, so let's start with the foundational distinction the book makes, because I think we have to stop conflating anger with policy disagreement. Mason says there are, what, three types of polarization, but only one is actively tearing the country apart.
That's right. You know, while political elites, we're talking folks of Congress, big donors, media pundits, they've become significantly more ideologically distinct, yes. But the polarization that defines the citizen level is what she calls affective polarization.
Affective. So emotion-based.
Exactly. This isn't about what you believe on issues. It's the measured emotional component. The intense dislike, the deep distrust, and frankly, the outright anger that partisans feel toward the outgroup, the other side.
And the beta she presents on this is, well, it was kind of shocking to me. Mason looks at decades of survey data, right, and finds that the average American citizen remains relatively moderate on a surprising number of policy issues.
Yeah, that's key.
We are polarized, yes, but we are not dramatically more divided on policy than we were decades ago. You know, we haven't suddenly shifted to complete extremes on taxes or healthcare across the board.
And that's the core puzzle she identifies. The ideological distance between the average Republican and the average Democrat has remained somewhat stable, maybe grown a little, but the effect, the emotional distance has absolutely skyrocketed.
Yeah.
So if we don't disagree on issues that much more, why has the contempt, the fear, and the distrust exploded?
Right. What does it come from?
It suggests the animosity is rooted not in policy platforms, but
well,
in the psychological structures of group identity itself.
Okay. That seems like a massive claim. If policy doesn't matter as much as we thought, what are we fighting about? Why is politics so incredibly toxic?
To answer that, Mason connects modern political behavior directly back to some pretty fundamental human psychology. She brings in social identity theory. This is the work of Toshfell and Turner, which basically shows our brains are kind of hardwired for tribalism.
Us versus them.
Pretty much. We instinctively think in terms of us versus them because our fundamental human need for self-esteem and belonging gets all tangled up in the status of our group. We want our group to be on top.
Okay, and this is where it gets really interesting because she illustrates how easily you can trigger this tribalism. She uses that classic psychological experiment, the minimal group paradigm. They use incredibly arbitrary, like meaningless criteria to divide people, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely trivial criteria.
Yeah.
Subjects in these experiments were randomly assigned to groups based on what, well, sometimes it was whether they preferred the abstract painter Klee or Kandinsky.
Seriously,
painters. Painter? Yeah, or sometimes just based on a coin flip. These groups had no shared history, no interaction, zero real-world consequence attached to them. Completely
right.
Meaningless groups.
And what happened? Did people still favor their random group?
Immediately. It was almost instantaneous. Even with that completely arbitrary assignment, people began favoring their own group and discriminating against the other group.
Yeah.
Like when they were asked to distribute points or small amounts of money.
Okay.
And here's the kicker. Subjects would frequently choose a distribution that resulted in less overall gain for everyone in the experiment if it meant maximizing the difference between their group and the outgroup.
Wait, hang on. You're telling me people would actually take less for themselves and their group just to make sure the other team got even less to win?
Exactly. ensuring their team won, even if the spoils were smaller for everyone, including themselves. It's about relative status.
Wow. Okay, so the crucial takeaway for you, the listener, is that group identity is this incredibly potent engine of conflict. It can be activated even without significant ideological disagreement or real material stakes.
Precisely. And this deep, almost primal impulse is what Mason argues is now being activated by our political parties. They've become the groups we'll sacrifice for just to beat the other side.
That sets the stage perfectly for the next big piece. How did our political parties transform? How did they go from being these like loose policy coalitions to becoming these deeply charged psychological tribes? This is the story of social sorting.
Right. So Mason points out that back in the mid-20th century, say the 1950s and 60s, American identities were much more cross-cutting. Your party affiliation didn't perfectly predict your other core identities.
Like what? Give me an example.
Well, you could easily find a conservative person of faith who was a Democrat, maybe a union member. Or you could find a liberal, non-religious person who was a Republican. The categories didn't line up neatly.
Yeah, I think people remember hearing about the conservative Southern Democrats, right? Or the liberal, sometimes pro-union Republicans, maybe in the Northeast. Your race, your religion, where you live geographically, it didn't perfectly predict who you voted for.
Exactly. But starting around the 1960s and 70s, that landscape began to change fundamentally. And it happened through this process Mason calls social sorting.
Okay, sorting. How did that work?
Key historical issues, really big, divisive ones like the civil rights movement, the later rise of the religious right, ongoing cultural clashes. These drove identities to align much more cleanly with party labels.
So groups started moving?
Massively. For instance, white Southerners shifted overwhelmingly towards the Republican Party over decades. Evangelical Christians became overwhelmingly Republican. At the same time, urban, secular, highly educated people moved overwhelmingly towards the Democratic Party.
So it was like a relentless stacking of identities over time. If you checked five boxes describing who you were, say, urban, secular, maybe non-white, highly educated, young, they all started pointing directly to the Democratic Party.
And if you checked the opposite five boxes, rural, religious, white, maybe less college education, older, they all pointed increasingly Republican.
Right.
And this creates the crisis point. What Mason calls the mega identity.
A mega identity. Okay, what does that mean?
It means when multiple core identities, your race, your religion, your culture, your geography, maybe even your favorite sports team or brand of truck, when they are all perfectly stacked and aligned with your partisan label, then an attack on your party isn't just a policy critique anymore. It's perceived as an existential threat. It feels like an attack on your entire community, your way of life, your very sense of who you are.
And that explains, maybe, why a debate over something like immigration or healthcare feels so intensely personal, so zero-sum. You're not just arguing about the best policy path.
No. You feel like you were defending the very existence of your tribe against this hostile other group that wants to destroy everything you value.
Okay, the consequences of having this mega identity must be huge, then.
They're vast. And one of Mason's most compelling, maybe even disturbing findings is that identity trumps ideology.
Identity trumps ideology.
Right.
Meaning the party label itself becomes the primary lens, more important than your own beliefs even.
Yeah, pretty much. Give us an example of how that plays out.
Well, Mason's experiments show this really vividly. If a political party changes its position on an issue, let's say a traditionally free market Republican Party suddenly takes a hard line against free trade, something they previously championed.
Okay.
The average Republican follower is far more likely to change their own personal belief on free trade to match the new party line than they are to say, wait, my party doesn't reflect my beliefs anymore. Maybe I should leave.
Wow.
Loyalty to the team comes first. Your principles often just follow along.
That is deeply troubling for a functioning democracy, isn't it? It implies followers are acting primarily out of party loyalty, this tribal loyalty, not based on reasoned policy principles.
Exactly. And this effective polarization, this intense group hatred, it actually motivates extraordinarily high political participation. People vote more, they donate more, they protest, they're very engaged.
But, and this is a huge but, Mason stresses that this motivation is fueled overwhelmingly by negative partisanship.
Negative partisanship, meaning?
Meaning the primary goal isn't really to achieve good policy outcomes or advance a positive vision. The main driver is the desire to defeat the opposing side, to punish the outgroup. It's politics driven by dislike, not aspiration.
So when the goal of politics basically becomes warfare, well, compromise stops being a necessary virtue and starts looking like a betrayal of your tribe.
Absolutely. And this intense loyalty encourages political leaders to violate longstanding democratic norms,
yeah.
maybe bend the rules, because they know their base will forgive almost anything, as long as it ensures the in-group wins and the out-group loses.
Governance itself kind of takes a backseat.
It takes a backseat to ensuring the survival and dominance of the mega identity.
Okay. So if Mason's diagnosis is correct, and it feels pretty compelling, then we can't solve this identity conflict with just better policy debates or throwing more facts at people or just asking everyone to be civil.
Right. Those solutions are aimed at the surface layer, the policy disagreements.
Right.
But the problem, as she frames it, is much deeper. It's psychological. It's rooted in identity.
So what is the solution then? Does she offer any way out? It sounds pretty grim.
Well, it is a grim diagnosis. But the only viable long-term solution Mason suggests is the deliberate, conscious recreation of cross-cutting identities. We basically have to unsort ourselves socially.
Cross-cutting identities, meaning we need identities that cut across the political divide.
Exactly. The application here is deeply social and maybe surprisingly simple, though not easy. You need to create and foster spaces where political affiliation is secondary or even irrelevant.
Like what kind of spaces?
Think about it. When a committed Democrat and a committed Republican are, say, volunteering together at the local animal shelter, or they serve on the same school board fighting for better resources, or maybe they're partners in a community gardening project.
Okay.
They are forced, through that shared activity, to see each other as more complex human beings. They share a common non-political goal.
Ah, so that shared identity, like fellow volunteer or fellow parent, acts as a bridge.
Precisely. It serves as a bridge. It reduces the all-encompassing power of the political mega identity. You start interacting with them as a teammate or a neighbor or a fellow choir member first. That makes their political label secondary.
And that presumably diminishes the contempt driven by the effective polarization we talked about.
That's the hope. It chips away at the yes versus them mentality by creating more us.
Okay, so this gives you, the listener, a really clear, actionable lens. The true solution to our political polarization crisis isn't just political, it's inherently social. It requires us rebuilding those civic bonds, those shared spaces that this process of social sorting has systematically weakened over the last 60 years or so.
Mason has definitely provided us with a sobering, but I think essential diagnosis. To summarize the two key points for you, the crisis is fundamentally one of identity, who we are, not just policy, what we think.
Right. Identity, not ideology, is the main engine.
And second, that intense identity conflict wasn't inevitable. It was largely manufactured by this specific historical process of social sorting, where our identities all lined up with our politics.
Okay. So as you move forward and think about this identity crisis in your own life, your own community, consider this final provocative thought we want to leave you with.
Mason focused heavily on the historical sorting drivers, things like civil rights, the rise of religion in politics, geographic shifts. But think about today's technological landscape. Think about social media algorithms, fragmented news sources, media bubbles.
Mm.
Aren't these things almost perfectly designed to reinforce our sorted identities?
Good question.
To keep us in our tribes and actually eliminate the kind of cross-cutting contact Mason says we need. If that's true, are we currently, maybe unintentionally, accelerating this mega identity problem? Are we making it even harder to rebuild the very social fabric that democracy seems to depend on?
That is definitely something to mull over and maybe explore in your own community and online habits. It's a challenging thought to end on.